Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Saif Danah, Associate Professor of Sociology and International Studies at the University of Wisconsin, who explains why he believes the action of Egypt's generals constitutes a counter-revolution against the popular uprising that ousted Hosni Mubarak from power earlier this year. Lumumba Akinwole Bondele of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, who talks about the need to bring together opponents of the death penalty and those working against racial bias in the U.S. criminal justice system. And Heidi Boghossian of the National Lawyers Guild, who discusses her group's legal intervention to stop police evictions of Occupy Wall Street activists and a lawsuit filed to obtain information on the federal role in the nationwide crackdown on the movement. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In Chicago, hundreds of community activists marched outside the mid-October convention of bankers and future traders, chanting "Tax Wall Street." Curtis Smith of National People's Action, the lead organizer of the protest, argued for a new tax on financial transactions, including trades on stocks, bonds, and derivatives, to fund human needs. The transaction tax, also known as the Tobin tax, could generate tens of billions of dollars to fund job creation, education, and environmental protection, while at the same time reducing destabilizing financial speculation. Activists in the United States and England have dubbed the tax on stock and bond transactions the Robin Hood tax. In Washington, D.C., National Nurses United, along with other unions, marched to pressure Congress to enact the Financial Transaction Tax, or FTT. An FTT bill was sponsored by Iowa Senator Tom Harkin and Oregon Congressman Peter DeFazio. In the lead-up to the recent G20 summit meeting, the European Commission endorsed enacting a transaction tax starting in 2014. The measure has strong backing from Germany's conservative Chancellor Angela Merkel and conservative French President Nicolas Sarkozy. The transaction tax was first proposed in the 1930s by economist John Maynard Keynes. According to the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a robust Tobin tax could generate $170 billion annually in new federal revenue. Aracelis Upia, a garment worker in the Dominican Republic, received a living wage when she began working for Alta Garcia, a new apparel company dedicated to providing decent wages and working conditions while competing directly with large international clothing conglomerates. Upia now makes $2.60 an hour to sew T-shirts, nearly three times the minimum wage in her poor Caribbean nation. Alta Garcia is the product of a unique partnership between anti-sweatshop groups and Knight Apparel, America's largest seller of college athletic clothing. For years, groups like United Students Against Sweatshops and the Workers' Rights Consortium have sought a production model to manufacture sweatshop-free clothing. An earlier effort, led by Ben Cohen of Ben & Jerry's ice cream fame, collapsed due to poor management. According to The Nation magazine, the new initiative started in an abandoned Dominican Republic factory that had closed after its workers voted to form a union. In February 2010, Knight CEO Joe Bosich invested $500,000 to repair and upgrade the plant. To be successful, Alta Garcia must establish a market for sweatshop-free apparel in the U.S. Student activists are now promoting the brand, which will need to compete with Nike and Reebok that have long had lucrative licensing deals with major universities. While serving in Camp Arif Jan in Kuwait, Captain Ryan Jean was ordered to visit the Army chaplain for stating that he did not believe in God. The chaplain berated the captain, now an intelligence officer at Fort Meade, Maryland. The Christian chaplain proclaimed the U.S. military was God's army and advised Captain Jean to immediately resign his commission. 3 years later, Captain Jean is seeking the Army's recognition as a humanist lay leader on the same level as Christian, Jewish, or Muslim lay leaders who aid chaplains in ministering to the troops. According to the Baltimore Sun, Captain Jean is one of a dozen atheists in the U.S. military seeking lay leader status. Thus far, none have been successful. Currently, the U.S. military does not consider atheists or agnostics members of an organized religion, and thus they are not eligible for lay leader status. In recent years, the U.S. military has faced numerous allegations of religious bias, especially at the U.S. Air Force Academy, where fundamentalist Christian staff members and soldiers have aggressively pursued religious converts. Less than 10,000 of the 1.4 million active duty members of the U.S. Armed Forces are self-declared atheists or agnostics. Supporters say many atheists remain hidden in the ranks, afraid to expose themselves to ridicule or bias that would hinder their careers. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
When tens of thousands of Egyptians gathered in Cairo's Tahrir Square last spring demanding the ouster of U.S.-supported dictator Hosni Mubarak, the nation's armed forces played a decisive role in forcing Mubarak to resign on February 11th. When Mubarak ended his 30-year reign in power, it fell to Egypt's Supreme Council of the Armed Forces to organize the nation's transition to democracy. Initially, the military promised a 6-month transition period, after which they would step aside and make way for civilian rule. But when the generals extended their leading role in government to 2 years, Egyptians again took to the streets last week, gathering in Tahrir Square and other cities, demanding a rapid transfer to civilian control, with some calling for a delay in the first round of parliamentary elections. Clashes between police and protesters left more than 40 dead just days before voters went to the polls on November 28th to cast ballots in the initial stage of the nation's first post-Mubarak-era parliamentary election. In flaming anger in the streets, the Egyptian generals stood by their plan to impose a constitution that would give the military control over its own budget and grant the army ultimate political power, as they appointed Kamel Ghansouri, a former Mubarak premier, as Egypt's new prime minister. While refusing to immediately step down, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces pledged instead that elections will be held for a new president by mid-2012, sooner than previously announced. Your reporter spoke with Saif Dinah, associate professor of sociology and international studies at the University of Wisconsin, who explains why he believes the action of Egypt's army constitutes a counter-revolution against the popular uprising that ousted Mubarak from power earlier this year.
The Supreme Military Council in Egypt was supposed to surrender power or relinquish power to a civilian administration that should oversee the writing of the constitution or the new constitution. Well, it was supposed to relinquish power 6 months after the fall of Mubarak, but they did not. It's been more than 10 months right now. And the assistant to the prime minister issued what is called supra-constitutional principles. Initiated by the Supreme Military Council, that gives the Military Council some kind of veto power over the new constitution and over the composition and the formation of the Constituent Assembly that would be chosen by the newly elected parliament to write the constitution. So in some sense, the Supreme Military Council is, after it took over the power of Mubarak, back in February, it's trying to remain the caretaker of the country and continue to control the country. But this is not really happening as part of kind of political regrouping in Egypt after the fall of Mubarak, and different groups have different interests now. Some have interest in a new election. Some don't have interest in a current election. They want the election to be held later, because they think the Muslim Brotherhood are well-financed, well-organized, and they will take over the parliament. I'm talking about most of the activists on the ground, really, who did not have the chance to organize in political parties the way the Muslim Brotherhood are. But it's part of a really political regrouping in the whole region. There is an attempt by regional powers and by global powers to abort the outcomes of the Arab revolutions in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Libya, in Yemen, in Syria, everywhere. And really the heading for discussing this issue in the Middle East by most Arab commentators is counter-revolution, that the Supreme Military Council in Egypt is a tool of regional and global counter-revolution against that attempts to abort the Arab Spring or Arab revolts. mainly by Saudi Arabia that has been financing such counter-revolution. And Saudi Arabia is known to be one of the most oppressive regimes in the world, have no interest at all in any democratic transformation, not only inside Saudi Arabia, but any part in the region, because they think that will affect the conditions in Saudi Arabia. And of course, we know that other global powers like the U.S., who supported despotic regimes for a very long time, and European countries like France, who have some interest in the region, mainly oil, like the scenario of Libya testifies, don't have any interest, really, or any genuine interest in democratic, in real democratic transformation in the region.
When hundreds of thousands of people across Egypt demonstrated to remove Hosni Mubarak from power, many people in those demonstrations viewed the army as a neutral arbiter and protector of the people of Egypt, helping to hasten the day that Hosni Mubarak left power. How has public opinion changed since the ouster of Mubarak?
Well, to begin with, there is a significant shift in the public opinion in Egypt regarding the Supreme Military Council. And they actually make a serious distinction, and that's really true, between the ordinary soldiers who are conscripts, they're the sons and daughters of the people of Egypt, and the Supreme Military Council, because it took over the office of the president. So they look at it as a committee with the power of president of the republic. Most of the people in Egypt, really, who participated, or the activists who participated in the revolution against Hosni Mubarak, are really intelligent, and they really understood from the very beginning that the Supreme Military Council was actually part of the Mubarak regime, and they still perceive it as such, and that explains much of its behavior, really. But obviously, the Military Council had no intention from the very beginning to surrender power, and that's what is bringing the current uprising against them.
There's been reports of a large turnout for voters coming out in this new parliamentary election. In the rounds of the election ahead for a new parliament, the first parliament since the fall of Hosni Mubarak, are these elections, in your view, free and fair from the reports you're getting?
You know, they're held over 2 days, and this is part of what's worrying some of the activists, that holding the elections in three parts, two days each, makes a room for some bad moves from the side of the Supreme Military Council. But that notwithstanding, you know, the elections most likely will be held and will be fair and transparent. The main issue here is, really, should it be held right now? And I think there is an issue with this, because a significant number of the forces on the ground are not really ready for it. So I won't be surprised to see the Muslim Brotherhood taking over most of the parliament, or a significant percentage of the parliament seats.
That was Saif Dinah, Associate Professor of Sociology and International Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. Find more information on the political situation in Egypt by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The controversial September execution of Troy Davis in Georgia raised the profile of the death penalty in the U.S. and the fight to abolish it. Davis was executed after spending 20 years on death row for the killing of an off-duty police officer, a crime for which he maintained his innocence to the end. Opponents of the execution argued there was no physical evidence linking Davis to the murder, witnesses recanted their initial testimony, and there are many doubts about how the state handled the case. Now groups promoting abolition of the death penalty are organizing community forums to galvanize support for action at the state level. One such forum was held at a local church in Hamden, Connecticut on November 22nd, focusing on the African-American community and featuring four speakers. One of those speakers at the event was Lumumba Akinwole Mondele, a senior community advocate for the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. He talked about the need to bring together those campaigning against the death penalty with those organizing against the criminalization of African-American men and women in the U.S., and expressed his belief that capital punishment will be abolished within the next two decades.
We are and have been dealing with the issue of apathy in black communities that dates back centuries, and we do not believe we can win. When your grandparents have gone through the same thing and their grandparents have gone through the same thing, what's to tell you that today, 2011, that you have the ability to change this, right? Part of my task is beginning to engage black communities to talk about some of these tough discussions. And we have to recognize that our communities, let's not talk about the state, Let's not talk about the governors. Let's not talk about the prosecutors who are issuing these. In our communities, we need to have a discussion on what justice is. Because when we close the doors in our homes, we know we live among people who do support the death penalty. And unless we're able to engage people as family, as neighbors, as friends, and really have those discussions, it's not going to matter if we march on the DA's office. It's not going to matter if we sit in front of the governor's office the night before an execution. We have to have those discussions within our homes, within our churches, within our community centers, within our schools, and come to a consensus that this is intolerable. Until that happens, we will continue to see more people executed. We also have to have an even more difficult discussion. And I wish I was bringing good news to you. But we have to have a more difficult discussion because we are looking at two areas of organizing that are happening in isolation. We are looking at communities that are doing work to deal with the issue of the criminalization of African people, of black people, and outside of that circle in discussions, we have a whole nother circle of people who are dealing with the issue of the death penalty. If the two are not connected, we will continue to have two different struggles that will continue to contradict each other. We have to have these discussions together. Some of the alternatives that are being discussed outside of those who are working around criminalization issues are alternatives that do not add up. Are alternatives, in fact, that are counter our existence as black people. Increased policing is not the answer. Tougher on crime laws is not the answer. And I hate to say it for those of you who are working hard on this, but believe me, life without parole also is not the answer. It's not. So, am I saying that it's easy? Absolutely not. But until we have these collective discussions, we will continue to have this isolation that will prohibit us from moving forward. All right? So we are looking at patterns that date back decades and centuries. We're looking at patterns that have and speak to some very fundamental traditions that this country has yet to really acknowledge. But I like for us to start at home. I like for us to really begin to engage each other. And we know who we are. We know those friends who say that, you know what? It is what it is. That's the only way that we can find justice. We know that those conversations happen. We have to begin to engage people and really struggle with those conversations so that we can really begin to talk about really what alternatives mean. I want us to begin to have these discussions in a very close, familiar kind of way so that we can really look at ways that we can end the death penalty. And let me say this, I guess the good news is that I actually believe that the death penalty within the next decade, maybe two decades, will be abolished nationwide. I believe that. When I look at the trends, when I look at the kind of energy that it's being mobilized around this, I actually believe it will happen. My concern is that this will not have any impact on the increasing numbers of black men and now women who are being thrown into prison. It's not an either or. Thank you.
That was Lumumba Akinwole Bondele of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund speaking at an event in Hamden, Connecticut on November 22nd. Find more information on the campaign to abolish the death penalty on our website at btlonline.org. In the 10 weeks since the original Occupy Wall Street protest encampment was founded in New York City's Zuccotti Park, the movement has spread to hundreds of other outposts across the U.S. and the world. The message of activists condemning corporate greed, economic inequality, and the corrupting influence of money in politics has resonated with many Americans who are suffering with high unemployment, a record number of mortgage foreclosures, and dimming prospects for the future. Although the U.S. Constitution guarantees the right of the people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances, Occupy encampments from coast to coast have been the target of dozens of police raids and evictions ordered by local governments. Disturbingly, some police departments have employed brutal tactics better suited to confronting a terrorist threat than a group of citizens engaged in lawful and nonviolent peaceful protest. Video images of police assaults with truncheons, bloodied faces, and pepper spray being fired into protesters' eyes at point-blank range have gone viral on the internet, generating a backlash against police and increased support for the movement. News reports on Oakland Mayor Jean Kwan's admission that she'd taken part in a conference call with officials from 18 other cities to discuss how to handle the Occupy encampments, and a leak from an anonymous Justice Department source, led many to conclude that the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI had helped to coordinate local police actions suppressing Occupy activists. Your reporter spoke with Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild, who talks about her group's legal intervention to stop Occupy evictions and the filing of a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit against the Department of Justice and other agencies to obtain information on their involvement in coordinating the nationwide crackdown on the Occupy protest encampments.
Since really 1999, when we had the World Trade Organization protests, we started to see, and it became known later as the so-called Miami model, but basically a nationally coordinated method of crowd control used by various levels of law enforcement. And one of the tactics that we observed before national special security events like the RNC, the DNC, was preemptive arrests, raiding of organizers' spaces. For example, when people were making puppets in Philadelphia at the RNC in 2000, pretextual raids saying that there was a fire code violation or a sanitation or health threat. And in case after case, when this went to the courts, it was found that these were pretextual raids. There was no violation. But it had the effect at the time of shutting down the speech in question or sort of slowing down what the protesters were trying to accomplish. And I think in examples that have come up at Occupy situations, for example, in L.A., well, the mayor allowed the encampment for something like 56 days and then cracked down. And, in fact, the city council there had said they supported the tents as expressive activity. So I think that in certain circumstances, even in New York, the encampment was allowed to a certain point. It's almost as though the mayor said, look, we let you be there for a month or so, and now we're sick of it. So I would say that most of the claims of sanitation problems are things that a city or a municipality could come up with solutions for and help accommodate the free speech activity. But we're seeing them used, in our opinion, to shut down this free speech, because in many cases it's just gone on too long in the minds of the local authorities.
Is there anywhere in the Constitution where there's a time limit on freedom of speech? It seems that these mayors and any national coordination that's going on is really looking at free speech having limits of a length of time. You've been here for 2 weeks, 2 months, time's up. I don't read the Constitution regularly, but I don't think that's in there.
There's no time limit, and I think that's really kind of the beauty of this movement, is I think many people thought it would be over in a week or two. Cold weather came, and yet the protesters not only were still there, in many cases they were gathering momentum.
I've read reports, as I know many listeners have, about the involvement of federal authorities, namely the Department of Homeland Security, in coordinating some of the local police responses and evictions and raids into Occupy Wall Street encampments in cities large and small. What can you tell us about that, and what is the National Lawyers Guild and other groups doing to get to the bottom of any kind of national coordinating effort in these raids?
the National Lawyers Guild, along with the Partnership for Civil Justice based in Washington, D.C., has filed FOIA, Freedom of Information Act request, to find out if there were communications or meetings involving the Police Executive Research Forum in October and November, also the U.S. Conference of Mayors, specifically to find out if there was anything, any documents or information pertaining to federal coordination, or even to advice or consultation regarding the police response to the various Occupy protests around the country. And I should add that after 9/11, we saw the Department of Homeland Security launching a network of fusion centers in 2003. There are 72 fusion centers, the purpose of which is to force diverse agencies to work together. So I can't imagine, with a vast Occupy movement springing up so quickly, that there isn't national coordination. It just wouldn't fit into the rubric of current law enforcement practices.
If indeed there is evidence that there is federal involvement here in the crackdowns on the Occupy Wall Street encampments, what does that mean to you? And is any of what's happening around the country, can it be challenged in court? Can a judge basically say, hey, look, this is free speech, and these local police forces and the federal government just ought to back down and let these people have their say?
Well, and that's our goal, is to challenge whatever we find if it seems to be unlawful practices that infringe on people's constitutional rights. The problem is, you know, the FBI, we had guidelines for many years that limited when you can open an investigation of political activists. Those guidelines, as your listeners probably know, after the events of 9/11, have basically been chiseled away, so that spying on ordinary Americans absent criminal activity, getting their telephone records, partnering with corporations who, by the way, in many cases work with local police or have their own intelligence gathering departments. So it's, I think, in the public's interest to know to what extent the government may be partnering with corporations, private security agencies, doing surveillance on individuals, invading our privacy. The goal is to find out as much as we can so that we can find ways to challenge these overreaching practices.
That was Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild. For more news, analysis, and commentary on the Occupy Wall Street movement, visit our Between the Lines special Occupy Wall Street coverage and resource page at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.